being passed around. Feel free to look at that during my talk. Feel free to go on the website and really investigate what really generated this talk today. May I ask for another show of hands? Is anyone a graphic designer in the audience? Or interested? Okay, quite a few. Interested in graphic design, interested in Miro. Well, they make perhaps strange bedfellows, as we shall see. And after seeing the fascinating painting and anti-painting show, I started thinking about the sometimes superficial connection between graphic design and Miro's work. And as curator Umland, I think, very exquisitely showed us, Miro's work was often extraordinarily abject in its insistence upon issues of the body. And I will show you some comparisons that I think, in light of the show here at MoMA, which did just close, open up very new and rather fascinating and indeed challenging ways for us to compare works of important 20th century graphic designers like Paul Rand or Alvin Lustig of the New York School of Graphic Design with Miro's abject anti-painting oeuvre. So without further ado, let's get started. As I said, the show took place November 2nd to January 12th. And indeed, look at the website, look at the catalog, and look at Miro's work in person. Here's a 1935 photograph of Joan Miro. And I'll give you just a little bit of background on his biography if you're not that familiar with him. He was born in 1893, died at the ripe old age, 1983. Catalan artist. He was a painter, a sculptor, a printmaker, a ceramicist, and indeed a graphic designer. And much of my interest in this theme has to do with the questioning of the old hierarchies that, of course, traditionally said that the applied arts, that utilitarian arts like design were down here in the hierarchy, and the fine arts of painting, sculpture, architecture would have been elevated way up here. He was also, and sorry I neglected to note this, a tapestry designer. And you may recall, rather tragically, that the most expensive artwork lost in the September 11th tragedy, 2001, was the monumental Miro tapestry. He was born in Barcelona, Spain, and, of course, famously became part of the 1920s Parisian avant-garde, where, of course, he got to know Cubism, got to know Picasso, and I'll talk about all of those influences when we look at some of his works and compare them with some works of important graphic designers. He was married in 1929, married Pilar Juncosa in Palma de Mallorca, his beloved Palma de Mallorca, Spain. Their daughter, Dolores, was born in 1931. And then bringing it all back home here to the Museum of Modern Art, in 1941, MoMA mounted the first true Miro retrospective anywhere in the world. So we can be, of course, yet again proud. This is what Miro would have seen, right, when he was here. Although this is from my own personal collection of really wacky postcards circa 1941 with this rather psychedelic coloration that we could almost argue came right out of Miro's paintings, but who knows? Part of the landmarks of New York City, and we of course still are a landmark of New York City. As Anne Umland so exquisitely and articulately put it, common things take on a heightened sense of reality in Miro's work, an effective wholeness, but one which strikes a mortal blow at unified, illusionistic modes of representation. So with that notion of a mortal blow, with the notion of annihilating, assassinating painting, why in the world would graphic designers working for a living, working for patrons, working for the man, so to speak, want to appropriate an artist who is literally annihilating art as we know it? And then I juxtapose that wonderful quote with a quote by Paul Rand. And here, of course, is a wonderful photo of Rand later in life, part of the slightly paradoxically part of the Apple computer, the Macintosh ad series, Think Different. And I say paradoxically because, of course, as most of you know, one of Rand's most famous series of logos was for their big competitor, right, for IBM. So graphic designer Paul Rand in 1981, and here's where it all ties together with Miro officially and formally. He was lecturing in Brissago, Switzerland. And what he said, one of the many things he said, was the problem of the artist is to defamiliarize the ordinary. And, of course, he, looking at Miro's fascination with the Dadaist, the Surrealist, and the notion of defamiliarizing the ordinary. In fact, specifically, Paul Rand, as part of his lecturing there in Brissago in 1981, was specifically utilizing Miro's language of form. And I would even suggest, and here I go out a little bit on a limb, appropriating some of Miro's extremely subversive methodologies for graphic design. This, of course, from the 1988 Think Different Macintosh, very, very popular canonical Macintosh ad campaign. What is graphic design? Just a little reminder that the term for the discipline was coined fairly recently, right, 1922, by an important American graphic designer, William Addison Swiggins, who coined the term really to give a name to what already existed, but to, again, canonize it, to make it official. And he described his activities as an individual who brings structural order and visual form to printed communications so that the emerging field, the emerging discipline, then gets an official name. Let's talk about Paul Rand and Alvin Lustig, the two designers that I will focus primarily on today in thinking about Miro's legacy. They were, as I said before, part of the so-called New York School of Graphic Designers in the 1940s and 50s. And they were, of course, following an earlier first wave of European avant-gardists coming to this side of the pond, and specifically to New York City. Certainly by the mid-20th century, New York City becomes the center of not just the art world, but the design world as well. And so what we see are artists and designers with a great diversity of cultural backgrounds. Paul Rand, interestingly, you probably know, born in Brooklyn, born Peretz Rosenbaum. And that name change, of course, rather sadly, tells us so much about the current climate and indeed, the, at least on his part, perceived anti-Semitism in the climate at that time in the United States. He is, or I should say was, he died in 1996, born in 1914, a brilliant editorial designer for magazines like Coronet, Esquire, Apparel Arts, Direction, and I'll show you many examples of Rand's work today. Very much inspired by the European avant-garde, inspired by the Bauhaus artists like Kandinsky, the so-called inventor, creator of what many argue to have been the first fully non-objective painting, Paul Klee, inspired by the Cubists, French Cubists, and, of course, by Dada and Surrealism, and, of course, Miro, who kind of defies categorization, doesn't he? He's as Anne Umland has really shown, a multifaceted and often very, very challenging and difficult artist whose work is often, quite frankly, and deliberately rather tough to look at. Rand believed in the expressive power of freely invented shapes. That said, he was inspired by expressionism, again, coming from the European avant-garde. He used, of course, avant-garde techniques like collage, montage, as we will see, very famously, again, his collaboration with Bill Birnbach, the Weintraub ad agency, and one of his manifestos, really canonical work, 1946, Thoughts on Design. There is a wonderful website if you're interested in Rand. It's paulrand.com. And it is just a great resource and will give you lots of links to other important Rand sources. When we think of Paul Rand, probably, you know, if we think very superficially, this is what we think of, right? His 20th century canonical logo design, some of the most famous logos in the world still today. Westinghouse, of course, IBM right in the center, not by accident, Big Blue, right? Yale University. UPS, sadly, no longer in use. And I'll show you the one that is. ABC Network. Next computer, remember that was Steve Jobs' project. There are a couple of earlier ABC logos, and then Paul Rand's brilliant use of the sans serif, Bauhausian type, very rational, very clean, very modernist, very enlightened, and yet he uses Moreau, and we'll talk about that in a moment. There's this earlier, I think really, really charming, really wonderful, you know, wrapped up like a holiday package for UPS, unfortunately, of course, redesigned in the 1990s, and there it is, it's very brown, not to be subjective. When we also think of Paul Rand, and it's always interesting how when we do these types of talks, there are so many symmetries and dialogues between other things going on at MoMA. For example, the Vic Muñez show, Rebus. And of course, the work on the right by Rand, also for IBM, is a Rebus, right? The standing in of a visual symbol, in this case, for the I, for the B, and for the M. Let's look at that IBM logo for a moment. And again, it's so canonical. It is such a foundational design that maybe we take it for granted. But I remind all of us that it was rather controversial in the beginning. And when you really look at that, and you could say, well, he's such a modernist. He's balancing positive and negative space. And yet, half of the logo isn't even there. It's nothing. It's blank. And so in a sense, we can really question to what extent that logo stands for the edifice, right, the solid edifice of IBM, or is its playfulness, and we always, no one will argue that Paul Rand is not playful, but I suggest there is just something that he's tweaking there a little bit, and ultimately he gets away with it, and he gets his paycheck as well. So let's really think of which is what graphic designers do, right? They work for commission, and as they should. Let's think about, again, MoMA's role in this dialogue between graphic design and Joan Miró. And of course, I pulled this out, the 1949 Paul Rand design for the cover of MoMA's exhibition from that year, Modern Art in Your Life. And exactly at this moment in 1949, think of what's going on in the fine arts. Think of what's going on with abstract expressionism, right? The general public then, and indeed often still today, and I know this because I give a lot of gallery lectures here at the museum, sometimes have difficulty with abstraction, right? How can a painting be both non-objective and expressive? How is that possible? Right? And there, of course, we get into the difference between recognizable subject matter and content and meaning. But that's another story for another day. Let's look at some possible inspirational pieces coming from Joan Miró, and many of which were on view here at MoMA in our recent show. I show you here the 1930 Miró relief construction, oil on wood, nails, staples, and metal on wood panel. What I'm thinking about here, though, is not just the obvious biomorphic surrealist form that seems to be paralleled here, and of course, in typical Rand, you know, whimsical, multi-layered fashion. He's got an artist's palette here. He's got a dinner plate, right, as if you're at the dinner table. Modern art is just part of life, and it's as familiar as your breakfast table, right? All good. But what I would suggest when we really look at the Rand, what is this here? Is this a knife? Is this a paintbrush with a bit of, and granted our color palette here looks very Russian constructivist, and of course Rand is fully familiar with the whole history of the European avant-garde, but does it look a little phallic to you? Just in combination with this rather ovoid form. Something else I would like to point out, and that is the really interesting spatial relationship that I think is suggested here with my rather Wolflinian old school art historical compare and contrast. What I'm saying, of course, here is that Miró in this assemblage, right? This is in effect a relief sculpture. It does jut out into our space, although, of course, my projection is tending to flatten it out. And, of course, Paul Rand's catalog cover is a printed, flat
planar piece, right? And yet, what Rand tends to do, like a good modernist, is deny our ability to perceive the spatial relationships in a rational way, rather like Miro does, and I'll show you some even more provocative juxtapositions to that effect. So that while Miro insists that this is both a painting and anti-painting, not painting, so too Rand denies us the ability to read this in one single rational way spatially. And we'll see that time and time again. Miro, of course, and here's one of those informational PowerPoints to hammer home, his paintings insist upon their surface and this give and take between 2D and 3D. Rand's graphic designs deny their intrinsic flatness, their printed flatness. They absolutely play and often challenge our perceptual abilities. I mentioned that 1981 lecture series in Switzerland, and of course, I pull this cover out. This is a 2008 Princeton University Press book written by graphic designer, American graphic designer Michael Kroger. And Kroger was there in Brissago and was party to that that pedagogical approach using Miro as a very specific tool for advancement of graphic design approaches, formal and content-wise. Just to tell you a little bit about Michael Kroger, he's in Cincinnati. As I said, he was part of that workshop with Rand and other important graphic designers. And the whole idea of Rand's approach was to use Miro as a point of departure, utilizing visual semantics. And that, of course, roughly defined, it's the manipulation of words and letters to suggest Miro's work. And again, I ask us to really think about that, because what is Miro's work really about? Again, superficially, we might say, well, it's about a kind of whimsical, calligraphic approach, obviously based on biomorphic surrealism, all very light and interesting and fun and childlike and primitivizing. But again, I ask you to look at that Antelope Lounge show, look at that catalog, and you will see, again, that Miro's work often had this extremely abject quality about it, very, very tough, and I think rather a challenge to translate into graphic design, utilitarian communication design. Here I show you a page from Kroger's book where you can see how he is utilizing Miro's name in this kind of, in this case, rather wonderfully whimsical way. In general, how do we categorize graphic design's debt to Miro? Very generally. Certainly the collage technique, all right? Certainly Miro's use of elemental symbolic forms, forms like the star, the bird, and of course when we say the star, we have to there right away qualify that, because maybe it's a star in Miro, but maybe it's a female reproductive organ, right? And again, the MoMA show really points out the extremely erotic and sometimes rather aggressive nature of Miro's symbolic and often dually communicating forms. In Miro, we see the debt in graphic design to a kind of balanced asymmetrical composition. And of course, we could argue that ultimately that goes back to the Japonisme, right, of the latter part of the 19th century, all filtered through European modernist avant-garde design. Those dynamic compositions with a very strong play of positive and negative space, right, all of which comes from, to a great extent, from Miro as well as from other European avant-gardists. That expressive line, that calligraphic line that we see still today, and maybe some of you as designers appropriate it somehow as well with an unconscious nod to Miro. And contrast of color, especially bright, primary, again, rather childlike, primitivizing colors. Strong influence of Dada on surrealism, of course. Childlike, primitive, even whimsical, but often ultimately with a punch. And boy, do we see this in Rand's designs around the period of World War II. And I'll show you quite a few, obviously very politicized designs. But then we need to think about Miro's assault on painting, right? Why was he assaulting painting? Or as it is often said, why was he why did he want to assassinate paintings? And here, as a design historian, I'm always interested in, and this goes back to the 19th century with William Morris and design reform, the moment when design is picked back up, and craft as well, picked back up, in a sense, out of the dustbin, and it then becomes, not that it didn't exist all along, but it becomes a discipline that was then considered as important as the fine arts. And I remind us that, as many scholars have pointed out, Peg Weiss notably, that the decorative arts or design played a huge role in the development of abstraction in Germany with the work of Kandinsky. Think about Kandinsky's early period in the German Art Nouveau, the Jugendstil, where he's designing reform dresses and elements of interior design, right? So it really was a generative force and nothing to be sneezed at. Of course, Miró is assassinating convention, right? Conventional notions. And of course, with a heavy dose of socio-political awareness, because of course, for Miró, those traditional approaches were bourgeois, right? And he was ultimately quite, we could even argue, revolutionary in that sense. Speaking of graphic design's role in the banishment of the old hierarchies, if later on you go right upstairs to our architecture and design collection, you will see this Peter Behrens wonderful graphic design, 1908, and indeed both of these. I'm not sure this one's in MoMA's collection, but it's part of that whole series done for the AEG, the German Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, say that three times fast, which is their General Electric, basically, state-run, as it still is state-run today. And of course, Peter Behrens considered the first true 20th century corporate identity designer, right? The first true industrial designer of the 20th century. Because, of course, he too started as a painter, as a Jugendstil artist. He's doing paintings, prints, etc. He designed his own house, right, in Darmstadt, part of that whole design reform of the latter part of the 19th century in Germany. He gets his big break, of course, when the AEG hires him, they commission him to redesign everything from soup to nuts. And again, today that's, you know, no big deal to us. It's very common. But for this artist, he's designing everything from their architecture. And here we see in this wonderful, very Japanese graphic design, his AEG turbine factory in Berlin. It's still extant today. You can see the AEG wonderful honeycomb logo, which he also designed, right? That notion of the busy bees, brilliant early logo. And then, of course, this amazing, quite decorative, right? And again, this isn't a lecture about Behrens, but he's, maybe next time, he's just so fascinating, where he utilizes here the language of post-impressionism, notably divisionism, right, to suggest not only this elegant monochromatic composition, but also the very energy of modernism itself. And of course, this is an advertisement for the AEG metal filament light bulbs. Fascinating. There were many other members of the avant-garde who did not look down their noses at design, or what we call the applied arts. Notably, and I show you here, of course, the husband and wife team, Sonia Delaunay-Turk and Robert Delaunay, both important abstract painters. And I show you there MoMA's wonderful Delaunay, Simultaneous Contract, Sun and Moon, and one of Sonia Delaunay's rather similar and contemporaneous paintings, Electric Prism. Both of them, of course, with this wonderful machine aesthetic suggested there. But maybe more importantly for my talk today, Sonia Delaunay's interest and fascination with the applied arts, not only in textile design, but graphic design as well. And I don't have a photo, but you've all seen that wonderful photo taken at the 1925 Paris so-called Art Deco exhibition, where she redesigned her Citroën. The idea that her design concept, rather like Mondrian's, rather like the De Stael notion, extended beyond that car or that quilt for her child's bed to the entire world. Certainly a notion of design reform. Let's bring it back, though, to graphic design. Let's bring it back to Rand. Rand says, collages don't imitate reality.
I think very Miro-esque indeed.
And let's do a bunch of Wolflinian comparisons here. Here's a work from the MoMA show on the left. Miro's preparatory work, which includes collage, drawing related to the work painting of 1936, graphite and color pencil on newspaper glued into his notebook. Obvious debt, right, to collage, to synthetic cubism. And then Paul Rand's Direction magazine cover on the right from March 1942, where you see Rand printing. So we've got this next level, right, of space or of stepping back, collage, which is then, of course, produced through the modern printing process. Here, of course, I show you a synthetic cubist collage by Picasso in our collection here at MoMA, which you probably are all familiar with. But lest we think that it was those synthetic cubists who actually invented collage, let's look back to graphic design, because indeed it was the Begerstaff brothers, which was the nom d'artiste of two academic painters, James Pride and William Nicholson. And of course, the story goes that they were quite respected academic painters and were quite frankly needing a little bit of extra loose change, but were embarrassed to use their high art names for the lowly job of graphic design. So they took a pseudonym, a nom d'artiste, and the story again goes that they saw that Begerstaff brothers on a sack of corn, you know, in a barn or in a stable or what have you. Of course, they're by now extremely canonical works and very, very early, 1890s. These are, of course, printed advertisement posters, advertising works, but they were created originally using cutout paper, which was then glued down and reproduced through the printing process. What I find so fascinating here, of course, is their incredibly innovative use of negative space, whereby the viewer literally has to fill in the blanks. Yet again, we can say, what a strong debt to Japanese color woodblock prints. Obviously, ukiyo-e prints, which were everywhere at the time. Remember, everyone from Frank Lloyd Wright, who was not just collecting them, but dealing them. Vincent van Gogh, you name it, across the board, the avant-garde early modernists looking at them. Let's maybe dig a little deeper and look at some more comparisons. This one I find quite interesting. On the left, I show you one of Miro's, this 1933 drawing collage, Conte crayon paint, sandpaper. So on the one hand, it's got, if you look carefully, you know, it's got this kind of wonderful curvilinear, you know, really fun calligraphic line, and we're attracted by these, you know, collaged elements, the, you know, the idealized female figures. But then look a little carefully, it's rather aggressively and obviously erotic. And then down here, the sandpaper, so it both seduces and repels at the same time. So what does Paul Rand do with that? Well, another Direction magazine cover, 1940. And again, I'm not suggesting this equals this. I'm just showing some possibilities from which Rand doubtless was inspired. If we look carefully, here's this kind of wonderful, rather Max Ernst-esque collage device here. And indeed, Miro, as you probably know, worked with Ernst. So Rand is assimilating all of it. You know, very seductive, very beautiful, and this wonderful placement, this asymmetrical balance with these bold stripes in the back. And yet, dare I suggest that the juxtaposition of this, can I really say a bit phallic, exclamation point seeming to peek up under the tutu of the dancer is maybe at second glance a little more suggestive than one might have thought. Here's another comparison, and of course, these Direction covers, very much reflective of the political climate at the time. I show you Rand's cover, December 1938. So what do we have here? We have Czechoslovakia broken apart, decimated, and again, I suggest that the Russian constructivist aesthetic extremely strong here, not only in the black, white, and red, use of positive and negative space, but in those very suprematist looking, very, very Leszczynski-esque geometric forms. What else is going on here, though? And I show you on the right, Miró's The Bullfighter, 1927 oil on canvas painting with this cruciform form again. Now, in an Umlaut's catalog, it is pointed out that this could well be interpreted as Miró's reference to the vestiges of the painting stretcher, right? So that just as he has annihilated painting, there is still a kind of gravestone, if you will, or a shadowy vestige of what painting used to be there in this wonderful red dot here. So let's think about that use of the cruciform shape as it appears over and over again in Paul Rand's work, one of his most political works, of course, this direction cover on the right, Merry Christmas, December 1940, where very much like Miró's use of actual sandpaper, we are, of course, attracted, no matter what religious stripe we are, to the elemental forms of the vertical and the horizontal. Remember that to Miró, the vertical, aka the masculine life force, and the horizontal, the feminine life force, those two harmonious, opposing but intimately connected, they were the basis of the harmony of the universe to Miró. So we see that cross, and of course here it has obvious political meaning. During World War II, it attracts us and it repels us. Notice how Rand, of course, with the amazing play with space, right, suggests, in this case, a rather trompe l'oeil, rather shallow space, with those rather disturbing red dots, which obviously here seem to suggest drops of blood. And what will happen when we try to open this, you know, this package with a landmine inside it, right, suggesting that the entire world landscape has exploded. Let's think about those red dots for a moment, though, because in fact they appear over and over again in Miró's work. And in Miró's work, and we'll get to that in a moment, they come not only from, yet again, Japanese ukiyo-e color woodblock print, specifically Hiroshige, right? And you will see those red dots, but they are often simultaneously, as we'll see in Miró's work, references to the body, to bodily fluids, to our corporeality. Paul Rand specifically talks about the use of the cross shape, and he calls it the crucifix shape. He says, remember, this is an artist who's changed his name to Paul Rand, so very interesting. It is significant that the crucifix, aside from its religious implication, is a demonstration of pure form as well, a perfect union of the aggressive vertical and the passive horizontal female. And of course, we know that comes again from the European avant-garde, most famously from Miró. So let's get back to some of these comparisons then. And just what might he have been looking at? And here I show you a very early Miró work. This, of course, was not in the Painting and Anti-Painting 1927 to 37 show. This is 1917, and we can see Miró working through various avant-garde movements in European painting. Notably, it looks certainly very symbolist, looks very post-impressionist, etc. This is oil and color print on canvas. And of course, I'm pointing this out because of the artist palette, which we see up there on the wall. What do we also see? We see the Japanese ukiyo-e print right there on the wall, very much like this famous self-portrait by, of course, none other than Vincent van Gogh. Many, many self-portraits that utilize this kind of symbolist, post-impressionist, expressive color, like the, I've always thought, rather outrageous self-portrait by Gauguin, where he shows himself as both a sort of, divine, personage, having had his artistic apotheosis, and as a true devil, as a true bad boy. And then I juxtapose this, because, boy, does Miró work that positive and negative space, where, in fact, there really is no shirt, right? And he plays with color a little bit, but it really is the background that is then, through this wonderful rhythmic and rather decorative use of stripes, defining the mass, or should I say the flatness, of that shirt. One of what I think are the most fascinating of the Miró early works from 1917, Prades, the village, oil on canvas there, and I juxtapose that as well with his canonical big blue stripes. Let's look at some other very, very well-known Paul Rand works, like the poster for the AIGA, American Institute of Graphic Art, 1968 on the right. And here, of course, this is really the work that caused me to think about this relationship because of the way that Rand plays peekaboo with our perception. This kind of use of biomorphic forms that go in and out, that are overlapped, that are collaged together, that ask us in this rather playful way to have a spatial give and take. And of course, I juxtapose it rather ominously, I think you'll agree, with this work, The Sign of Death, with this, at first glance, you know, beautifully harmonious asymmetry in this work on, of course, the raw canvas. So it has this, again, kind of, you know, abject, kind of grubby quality. Very beautifully composed. There's that cross shape again. But then, of course, when we see the title, we start thinking, well, what exactly is that, a pool of blood, right? How do we view that? Do we view it from above, from the side? And when we really start to look at the Paul Rand design, and there are those dots again, right? This has often been interpreted as a clown's face, right? Very, excuse me, abstracted, the two eyes, a big nose, and a mouth. But if you look at it like that, it's kind of a leering, grotesque clown's face. And everyone knows that clowns are a little scary, especially to kids, or they can be. So it is a rather, it's also a figure with the arms up. But there's something, once we start thinking about where some of these ideas may be coming from, and maybe not even fully consciously, there is maybe a little bit of a subversive or darker side here. I'll just show you several more, what I think are interesting juxtapositions. Miró, of course, over and over again in this collage, 1927. This Conte crayon flocked paper, right? This is when he is creating this textural surface, and this kind of overlapping, this kind of biomorphic form, which is, I think, quite clearly very sexual in content here, very phallic form, and then we compare those to some of Paul Rand's forms. Again, we think of Paul Rand, we think, whimsical, upbeat, wonderful colors, very bright, very fun, sometimes rather violent indeed. And I thought this was a tremendously interesting comparison, where we see the Miró work of 1934, gouache and pencil on paper, with this kind of bird-like attenuated calligraphic linear form stabbing into this circular form here, not unlike what Rand is doing for his applied artwork, the graphic design on the right. It's not only Paul Rand who is absolutely challenging form and content often in Miró. I show you a photo here of Alvin Lustig. And of course, as you probably know, in German, Lustig means really fun, kind of a jolly guy. Let's look at some of his work, 1915 to 55. He split his time between New York and LA, although he was very much part of the New York School of Graphic Design. He was also importantly an interior designer. Right, so he really worked in both areas. His debt is, extremely clear. And I make this comparison between Miró's 1926 person throwing a stone at a bird. That's kind of aggressive. And what do we see here? Of course, here's Lustig's book jacket for Anatomy of Interior Designers, 1948. Very, very much of its time. Very biomorphic. Very surrealist. But here's a head chewing on a leg, right? So there's something, when you really start to look at this, what's this, right? Well, it's a few different things. You know, it's fun, it's upbeat, it's a little disturbing when you really start looking at it. And even, of course, the typeface, that calligraphic, so 1948, right? Very much inspired by Miró's calligraphic line. Here are some more. And again, very much of their time, very very retro looking today. Again, yet again, very popular again today as styles tend to cycle around. But let's look at what's really going on here. First of all, what are they illustrating? D.H. Lawrence, right? And secondly, and what I find most disturbing about the design on the left, what do we have going on here? Is this sort of chest hair that's become disembodied from these obvious surrealist forms inspired by, and Lustig is a real crock pot of installations. I love this Henry Moore-esque sculptural form down here. This may be an unlikely comparison, getting it right back home to MoMA. There is, of course, the MoMA exhibition cover, The New Decade, European Painters and Sculptors, from 1955, designed by Alvin Lustig. And, of course, the canonical work by Miró, there, 48, from 1927, oil and aqueous medium on glue-sized canvas. There is one of Miró's, and this is a good example of that kind of spattering of the red dots with this sort of celestial star-like form, but which can then conversely be related to aspects of our human physiognomy. So what in the world am I comparing here? What could be more different than Alvin Lustig's obvious, you know, Swiss style, rational, right, modernist, almost all negative space, clean design. And yet, of course, look what he does. He's got this wonderful little Dada-esque approach where he makes the European painters and sculptors a little bit illegible by collaging over that 22. And look at the typeface style of the 22, right? Much more calligraphic, much more, if you will, curvilinear, much less international Swiss style, rational, modernist. Getting back to Paul Rand, here's another one of those, and boy, there's a dissertation here in the writing, these Direction magazine covers. This January-February 1939. Paul Rand, of course, channeling everyone from Miró to Matisse, you know, this kind of childlike form, also the Russian expressionist, the Russian constructivist, right, with these abstracted forms. There's that star form again. There's Miró's star form, rather oddly hovering in space and really denying our ability to read this as a figure. Getting back to Lustig, what I think is one of the most complex of his designs, here, Fortune, December 1946 on the right. At first glance, it's obviously surrealist, very strong debt to Yves Tanguy's sort of hallucinatory underwater-esque surrealist landscapes of the mind, right? And of course, Dali as well. So what do we have going on here? Well, first of all, what in the world is this? You know, is this a sea anemone? What is this? Is this a woman's brooch? Is this a surrealist piece of fashion design? Is it a pincushion? Are these needles? And indeed, they are needles. And of course, this is a pearl, reinforcing that undersea concept with this very Miró-esque thread with the, they're not really pearls, they're flat dots, just as these are dots as well. So very complex combination of imagery, flat space. There's Malevich's flat suprematist square, a very strange work. And I think even stranger when we go back to the MoMA recent show of Miró's Painting and Anti-Painting, where we see, and boy, does this not reproduce very well. If you look very carefully, you can see the format of Portrait of a Dancer, 1928, one of his most really minimal yet so pregnant with meaning and tactile, both an attractive aspect and a rather repellent aspect, feather, cork, and hat pin on wood panel with repelling with paint, which was, of course, a material that the ultimate modernist architect Le Corbusier embraced as well. So this wonderful Miró-esque reference here, not only in the calligraphic, typographic reference, which we see up here as well, but also in this collaging of what were truly 3D elements, but again, which Miró calls still painting, right? He was quoted as saying, you know, I am first and foremost a painter. I'm somehow still painting when I'm creating these anti-paintings, because you can't have anti-paintings without paintings. Here I show you an obvious comparison. This Miró, the Hunter, Catalan Landscape, Montreux, July 1923, Winter 1924, where he too is investigating this notion of a kind of a landscape of the mind with, yet again, these sort of celestial, star-like, but also creature-like elements that he has invented, which I compare with this one. Some more Rand Miro-esque comparisons. Of course, here, the famous beautiful bird revealing the unknown to a pair of lovers. That's from Miro's celebrated Constellation series. And they've been described, of course, as referencing, among many other things, the cosmic heavens. And I compare that, of course, with one of Rand's very fun, very upbeat. You know, he did children's book covers. He's remarkably productive throughout his long career. This, the Paul Rand monograph, 1953, with the obvious, you know, references to Japanese art and other non-Western art. Then I compare to one of Alvin Lustig's designs, a book cover for Rambeau's work. And if you know Rambeau's work, well, you can certainly say that Lustig is perhaps investigating the dark side in his design. And of course, this is A Season in Hell, 1945. It does have a red background. Sorry, I have it in a monochromatic slide here. So let's look at some of these images, which again, at first glance, look very much of the time, very biomorphic, but they're actually quite violent, quite sexual. And again, clearly he is responding to Miro's visual language of form. Another comparison here, Miro, who, as I will show, also embraced graphic design specifically and also was an avid and prolific printmaker. And I show you one of his prints here, 1947 to 49, with that calligraphic line really being explored here and these sort of archetypal figurative forms that he developed so articulately. Let's look at some of Miro's graphic design works from his very large oeuvre. This I thought was quite an interesting and maybe unlikely comparison with Paul Rand's poster series for Interfaith Day, 1951, Photolitho, with this obvious reference to collage, but also utilizing what I think really comes directly from Miro, but which he interprets in his very own way. And I show you one of Miro's posters. Miro, of course, had a long and productive relationship with the Gallery Mag, and we will see many posters that he did for exhibitions there of his own work. Editorial book design, here I show you the frontispiece from Surrealism, 1947, edited by Breton with Miro. And then here we go. Here are some of the very well-known Gallery Mag posters, this from 1948, where Miro is, you know, very obviously celebrating the lowly art of graphic design, just as he did ceramics, tapestry design, etc. Here's some of his lithos. Very interesting in light of our current exhibition on Italian futurists, right? And if you look at some of the futurist graphic designs with their wonderful expressive use of typeface, clearly, Miro is very cognizant of those avant-garde works as well. Here are a few more of the Gallery Mag exhibition posters, which Miro seems to never have tired of executing. A final one on the left, and then on the right, Catalonia Today, his beloved Catalonia. A lecture like this probably brings up more questions than it answers. And that's actually good, because I think that the recent MoMA exhibition was highly provocative in asking us to rethink the true legacy and the true multiple meanings of Miro's oeuvre, particularly in that short decade period, 1927 to 37. So I do ask you on your own to look more into what may on the surface appear to be a rather superficial influence coming from this important modern European master, Johann Miro, and his legacy in the graphic arts. To finish up, I would suggest that that legacy still continues. Perhaps you know that on April 20th, 2006, which would have been the 113th birthday of Miro, Google took it upon themselves to design a Miro-esque Google logotype there, for which they got in a great deal of trouble. A writer, Elise Ackerman, wrote for the Mercury News, quote, after angering authors last fall with a wide-ranging book copying project, Google may now be alienating some visual artists as well by allegedly reproducing famous works in drawings on the search giant's homepage. Today, April 20th, 2006, the family of Moreau is upset to discover elements of several works by the Spanish master incorporated into Google's logo. Google has since taken the logo off their site. Google had altered their logo in celebration of Miro's 113th birthday. And then Wikipedians picked it up, as they always do right away, and they noted that ARS, Artists' Rights Society, which is located here in New York City, with whom I have dealt in person, and you don't want to mess with ARS, a group that represents hundreds of artists, including Miro's, their estate, more than 40,000 visual artists in their estates, asked Google to take it down, and indeed they did. In a written statement, though, to the Mercury News, Google said that it would honor the request, but that it did not believe its logo was a copyright violation. Miro's legacy exists in places you would never in a million years expect. For example, his 1982 large-scale public sculpture, which we see a photo of on the left, erected in Barcelona, Woman and Bird, was the inspiration for Nike's Air Jordan version 7, which came out in 2008, inspired by Woman and Bird. And I show you those Nike trainers, or sneakers, as we call them on this side of the pond, on the right. And then just yesterday, as many of you no doubt noticed, Google's homepage paid homage to another important modern, little later, master mid-20th century, of course, Jackson Pollock's birthday. But as you no doubt noticed, when you put your cursor over the Pollock painting, it said Jackson Pollock's birthday, courtesy of the Krasner Pollock Foundation, ARS, New York. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Are you ready to go and look at that MoMA show again if you saw it? Look at it virtually online. Please feel free, who has the catalog, by the way? Feel free to keep passing it around. Are there any questions? All right, well, thank you so much for your time. Paul, yes, question.
I have a comment on your observation that Rand wanted to suggest three-dimensional space in his graphic work. I thought that was a useful generalization for looking at the Lustig Fortune cover of 1946, because there he has pearls represented two-dimensionally with the thread going through the pearls to the three-dimensional representation of the needles surrounding the pearl. So it's both an assertion of two-dimensional space and an assertion of three-dimensional space.
You're so right, in a way that is sometimes rather disturbing and rather destabilizing even, which was, of course, the very notion of Dada as an anti-art movement, and indeed surrealism, right? The idea that, and this I suggest runs rather counter to the presumed purpose of graphic design, which is to communicate quickly and clearly. Right, I've been lecturing on the, and it's a great comment, Paul, I've been lecturing on the Batista Maddalena movie posters commissioned by George Eastman in that, you know, short four-year period of time. Remember, Eastman said, look, they need to read very quickly from across the street, from inside the trolley car. And that is traditionally what graphic design does. It communicates, and again, you know, for better or for worse, we're in the, you know, we're modernism here. We're all about the functionality, the rationality, the high-mindedness, presumably, of modernism. And yet, as we see over and over again, there is so often another story or stories. And there is even sometimes this destabilizing, perhaps dark side, this apocalyptic side, certainly to Miro, where he said, I'm going to assassinate painting. You know, that's very, very aggressive. And it's hard to, you know, approach graphic design working for, you know, a client with those radically anarchistic ideas, but somehow Rand and Lustig get away with it and are celebrated, and I think we should love that.
I think he's asserting here the connection of opposites, those dark and light spaces. spirals connected at the upper right suggests that he wants us to consider the way opposites are nevertheless connected.
Oh, you're so right, Paul. You're so right. They're very yin and yang, aren't they? Very. I also love the obvious aspect of gender in that work, because that looks like, to me, one big honker of a woman's brooch, you know? And perhaps we read that differently today in 1946 as perhaps something we wouldn't necessarily want to wear as women. Oh, thank you so much. But clearly, even at the time, there is this very decorative, very, very almost glitzy reference there. And then when you look more carefully, you see that it will hurt you. They're needles. So they're you know, it's a sea anemone. It's a spiky, spiny object that is also glitzy and beautiful. And of course, the pearl. And you noted the other flat pearls. That's a, you know, traditional reference to idealized beauty, usually feminine beauty. So Lustig is certainly in touch with, shall we say, his both sides of his gender designing identity, if we wanted to stereotype forms as being, which of course we can't, you know, feminized or masculinized. Very good point, Paul. Thank you for that.
The brooch also suggests an explosion to me, and the difference between creation and destruction is suggested.
Absolutely. Oh, you're so right. I think it's a very good design, and yet it's not pretty. It's such a mess. Nothing matches. It's all very disjunctive, don't you find? They're odd, almost grotesque combinations of 3D and 2D, and those yin and yang spirals just hang down there. It's just wrong on so many levels.
The Esquire covers.
Yes.
Are there any that are reflective of this that we should really focus on?
Look at the paulrand.com website, because they have all the editorial design, albeit although I should say the images are rather small. That's a little...
But I just said, you know, in I thought maybe that's why this lecture was given, so to give you a little bit more insight when you looked at the Esquire covers.
I found so much in this area that I didn't even start to move there yet.
That's great.
Oh, thank you.
My last question was, Picasso, Miro, I'm sure yes. Other artists did all of them design.
Yeah, Picasso did too, absolutely. And I think I mentioned that on Tuesday, and I forgot today.
But I think it's interesting that they did that. Now you, like, can you see Pollock making a tapestry?
You know, yeah, good point.
Chuck Close has done that.
And he's so interesting.
Yeah,
he is so.
But I think it's funny how it skips a generation.
No, it's very, very interesting.
So I just
And yet we could argue that look at some of the women artists, you know, coming of age, say, in the 50s, and then they move into, you know, totally appropriating the low arts of applied arts design. Yeah, very interesting.
Anyway,
good point.
Oh,
you're most welcome. Thank you for your interesting
comments.
Thanks for coming.